I live somewhere rural in Ireland. All the farmers near me will always keep cash under their mattress, right? Because they remember the 2008 crisis. Their level of sovereignty does matter. I think it's just back to that control, right? If the merchant, if the provider, whoever is saying, look, if you really want control, you can have it. I think that's one of the strongest vote of confidence from a company you can get.
Get ready to jumpstart your week with the FCAT Crypto Brief, brought to you by the Fidelity Center for Applied Technology. Join us as we delve into the hottest topics, from blockchain breakthroughs to DeFi revolutions and market happenings. We promise to go deeper than the headlines and deliver market insights you can't get just anywhere. Be sure to hit subscribe for your bi-weekly dose of crypto commentary. Quick disclaimer, we're here for education, not investment advice. Views expressed are of the hosts, not Fidelity or its affiliates. Crypto is a wild space, highly volatile, can become illiquid anytime, and is strictly for those with a high risk tolerance. Buckle up, enjoy the ride, and let's dive into what's been happening recently.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of the FCAT Crypto Brief. I'm Matt Allen, and this week I'm joined by David Shapiro and our new co-host, Dom Breslin. Gentlemen, welcome to the show. It's good to have you. And Dom, just for our listeners who might not know you, could you give a quick intro?
Yeah, for sure. So I started a long, long time ago in college doing CS way back when. And then like many people in 2017, fell down the crypto rabbit hole. And then since then, I worked for a couple of crypto startups. And then more recently, I joined Fidelity on the FDAS side. That's the institutional digital asset trading. And then tinkered around enough with the technology to be put into labs where I built a crypto retail portfolio tracking app. And then more recently, I've been working on a B2B crypto data API platform.
Very exciting. So you have a wealth of experience. We're really excited to have you on the show and to be a regular member of the crew.
Yeah. Well, thanks a lot for having me.
I think there's definitely some news that we need to cover. David, do you want to start us off with some news about Coldcard?
This is a sort of a sad story to cover, but around July 30th, people started noticing on chain that there were some suspicious movements of funds related to Coldcard wallets. And I guess to back up, Coldcards are Bitcoin-only cold hardware wallets made by a company called CoinKite. And these were very popular among the Bitcoin crowd, especially the Bitcoin-only crowd. A lot of people liked the fact that cold card wallets were Bitcoin only because it means things like their firmware only contains code to handle Bitcoin transactions. And there's not, you know, a bunch of, call it, altcoin software and code commingled with the Bitcoins, you know, inside the build of the wallet. So anyways, people started noticing these irregular movements on chain shortly after CoinKite came out with a blog post saying that there was an issue in the random number generation for seed phrases that were generated with certain versions of the firmware. So you could have used your cold card to generate a seed phrase in a private key a few years ago on a certain firmware version that was affected. And even if you had updated your firmware since then, because your seed phrase was generated on an older firmware version, you are still affected. So this is effectively what CoinKite said in their blog post. And they're saying if you generated a seed phrase on these firmware versions, you're at risk. And these versions spanned a few years. And so once this was disclosed, it created a race from lots of actors out there to see if they can exploit these seed phrases. And so the attack has sort of been ongoing, likely by multiple parties at this point. And so thousands of accounts have been affected at this point. I think the total amount swept in dollar terms is well over 100 million at this point. And it's tough because, you know, the users of these hardware wallets were following best practices, didn't really do anything wrong, and were still affected. You know, in a lot of cases, they went out of their way to do something that they thought would secure their coins even better by using a cold hardware wallet rather than keeping their funds on an exchange or something, and were still affected. And so there's a lot of interesting things to discuss here. One is, had CoinKite noticed this vulnerability, how would they have disclosed it in a way that didn't create a race to exploit it. If they said, hey, if you generated your seed phrases on these firmware versions, you need to move your funds to a new account, it would still effectively broadcast the message that these funds are at risk. So I think even if they wanted to disclose this responsibly, it would probably be difficult. And the other side of this is the AI angle. So we don't know if AI was used to find this exploit or not. But what we do know is that open source models can find it. So people have gone and used open source models that were, that came out before this had been discussed online and have shown that like GLM 5.2 and older versions can actually identify this random number generator bug. So this is all hindsight. But what's also interesting is that if you try to use some of the closed source frontier models to like research these things, a lot of the times they assume you're doing something malicious and will downgrade you to an earlier version of the model. So if you go to a model like Claude, for example, and you say, hey, I work for CoinKite and I'm auditing my hardware wallet's code, like, do you see any vulnerabilities here? Claude might say something like, well, I don't know for sure if you work for CoinKite and you may be trying to exploit this, so this is going to trigger, you know, a safety feature. Whereas with the open source models like GLM, they have less safety features baked in. And so they're more willing to do this type of defensive work. And even in the Hugging Face hack that happened a couple of weeks ago, this was between OpenAI and Hugging Face and didn't have anything to do with crypto. Hugging Face came out and said, we had to use GLM, which is an open source model, to research this incident because the frontier models, you know, based out of the US, have too much like safety features baked in. And so it raises the question, like, if we probably should be able to use the most advanced models for defensive work, but it's really hard to tell the intent of the user. And so now the offense and the defense are all using these older open source models, but there's no like defensive edge there. So, you know, ideally, good guys or people based in the US could use the most advanced models available to do defensive work. But at this point, it's not very easy. So no, that was a long tangent, but that's basically what is going on with the cold card hacks.
Yeah, certainly. Thank you for I think going into detail there. I think it's important for everyone to understand what happened and kind of all of the implications of this hack. And certainly like all condolences to affected users. It's tough to see, especially users who have put so much thought into their own security and self-custody, be affected by a hack like this. And we certainly don't want to opine on what this might mean for self-custody and user behavior in the future. But I think as kind of a point to watch, it will be interesting to watch the discourse, especially from like the very hyper-security focused users and whether they're more accepting of having coins on exchanges, using ETPs, etc. And I think how that thinking develops going forward. And then also, I think on the open source front, as you mentioned, David, it is really interesting to see this sort of offensive defensive game being played with the frontier models. And how do you possibly provide the best defense without also providing the best offense? So I think that's another trend to follow and to watch.
One thing was what I want to raise is, so Cold Card was fully open source, even their firmware is open source. And open source code is typically advertised as having a security edge or a security advantage because the code is open and reviewable by everyone, then bugs and vulnerabilities can be spotted because there's just more eyes on it. And as we've seen in the past with even cryptographic software like OpenSSL, bugs can persist for a long, long, long time before anyone notices. CSS injection bug in OpenSSL existed for 14 years before anyone noticed it. And the Heartbleed bug also existed for many years before it went noticed. So I think it prompts a second look at the claims around like superior security of open source code. I think that it's like a theoretical advantage, but in practice, it may not buy you the security advantages that everyone thinks the transparency gets you. The second thing I want to talk about very quickly is entropy and private keys. So I probably should have covered this a little bit more in detail earlier, but when you use a hardware wallet to create a private key, the hardware wallet, you need a source of randomness to create a private key. And hardware wallets typically use random number generating libraries to do so. But a lot of them will have additional sources of entropy. So they will let you like roll a dice 100 times, or they'll let you add a 25th word to your seed phrase. And so if that source of randomness is compromised or predictable in any way, then it makes your private keys not secure. And so that's basically what happened here with ColdCard, is this bug caused the firmware to fall back onto a less random number generator. And so it made brute forcing the keys easier. And even users who opted for ColdCard's 25th word, like adding an extra word to your seed phrase, even those accounts have become compromised. And really the only safe users are the ones who actually went through the process of rolling a dice 100 times correctly and you know, basically creating their own source of entropy, which is a tiny fraction of the amount of users.
Yeah, I think that's important context. It really highlights the need for strong entropy and randomness when generating these seed phrases. I think from a non-technical point of view, you know, a lot of people have maybe used like the Excel function equals rand. And it seems like very simple, like, oh, it's just a random number. But actually, technically speaking, generating true randomness is a challenge. And you can't use any random number generator. You have to use a non-deterministic random number generator. But with that, I think maybe we can move on to the topic of the day, which we're talking about payments, payment infrastructure, and agentic payments at the end as well. So I think maybe a good place to start is we've seen Stripe acquire Bridge, which is a stablecoin infrastructure provider, for $1.1 billion. We also saw earlier this year, MasterCard acquired BVNK for $1.8 billion, which is another stablecoin infrastructure provider. But what are these companies? How do they function in the stablecoin market? And why do we see these large payment providers going after stablecoin infrastructure?
I can jump in and take a little bit. I think to add to that, you can see even more companies doing it right. We can see Kraken purchase Magic and Embedded Finance. So I think what we're starting to see is different incumbents and newer players start to try and verticalize different parts of the stack, or what they see as the next part of the stack of the future. So I can find it really, really interesting. And I think when you look at the likes of Stripe's purchase of Bridge, it's because they're seeing clear volume, right? I think with Bridge, they have massive growth. They're up to about $5 billion worth of volume there. So these are just one of the many new companies coming in and kind of showing their technical prowess and the talent on the teams. And I think that's getting very much so noticed by the large players, the Stripes, the MasterCards.
Yeah, I think that Bridge is ultimately a set of APIs that enables global finance by leveraging stablecoins. And, you know, Stripe is obviously involved in payments and payroll on a global scale. So I think it makes sense for them to acquire a company like Bridge, considering they're already in the business of sending money around the globe. And they've essentially made a bet that stablecoins will, you know, further that business.
Yeah, certainly. I think that makes sense. And what I think is also interesting is it is playing out as I think a lot of industry participants in crypto predicted, right? Stablecoins allow for faster, cheaper settlement. And so it's not surprising maybe that you see payment companies going after these stablecoin infrastructure providers. But I think also on the payments front, what is an interesting trend that we're seeing that I'd like to get both of your thoughts on are embedded wallets. And when people say embedded wallets, like, what does that mean? How does that function? How is it different from self-custody wallet? How is it different from having a card in my Apple wallet? What is an embedded wallet?
I think you can really think of it as just like a user-controlled config, right? There's been a world where we've been very self-custody, do it yourself as cold card, and then the, hey, just leave it on the exchange. And I think companies like Privy and Stripe are recognizing this, or seeing that actually there's a total spectrum here, right? So I think embedded wallets are really trying to abstract a lot of the UX complexities that, candidly, a lot of crypto people have just tolerated for a long time. And I think they're trying to make it much more usable and also configurable where, hey, if you lose your private key, wouldn't it be great if the company could help you get it back, right? So there's a whole varying degree of configuration that will support multiple different use cases. And I think they recognize that. So Stripe's purchase of Privy is really saying, hey, we recognize that. And then you pair that with something like Bridge, which is a bad analogy, might be like a Visa, right? A plumbing of it. When you start to stack these things together, you can see a pretty well-oiled machine.
Yeah, a good way to spot an embedded wallet is if it's like inside the application itself. So typically, the way that these things would work before the embedded wallet paradigm emerged is you bring your own wallet to the application. So you pull up Uniswap, you pull up DeFi, and then you go to your MetaMask wallet and basically bring it yourself. And so you're sharing one account among lots of different applications. You use that same account on Uniswap and Aave and all of DeFi. Embedded wallets typically present in a way where you log in with a social login with like Google or Apple, and then you're inside the app and you have your account there, but that account doesn't necessarily leave that app. Sometimes it can be ported over, but for the sake of this discussion, you know, embedded wallets typically tend to present where it's one distinct wallet per application, and then you have lots of embedded wallets to manage. So that's sort of the main trade-off, is one account across multiple applications or distinct accounts, and, you know, different pros and cons for each way.
Yeah, I think another interesting aspect on the embedded wallet front is, I know we started this conversation out talking about self-custody and some risks with hardware wallets. But as I think about accessing DeFi, dApps, et cetera, using an embedded wallet really presents a spectrum between like what is kind of a form of self-custody and what is just fully custodial. So I'm curious, how do you both think about the risks of using an embedded wallet? What should users try to understand about the security trade-offs that they might be making when using an embedded wallet?
So embedded wallets have lots of different key setups. But typically, the way it would work is, I know with Privy, they do a Shamir secret share on your private key. So they take it and they split it into two pieces, and then they store them in different places. And then when you go to spend, because you're logged in or you're authenticated via Google or Apple, that gives you the permission to go to Privy and ask them to spend your funds. And so it's hard to say, like, is this purely self-custody or this is purely third-party custody? It sort of blurs the lines between the two. And I think it just depends on how you define self-custody, if it would actually be considered self-custody or not. And so I think that embedded wallets like appeal to like product owners a lot because it has really good, really superior UX. And, you know, your product owners are maybe more willing to sacrifice on something like user sovereignty over like a better UX. And so that's basically your fundamental trade-off, is users don't have to onboard with a wallet and fund the wallet, right? If you're coming to use this app for the first time and you don't have MetaMask or crypto wallet already, then you have to go off and do that and fund that wallet. And that can be, you know, that can be bad for your conversions. Whereas with an embedded wallet, you can start immediately, have your wallet, and even the wallet admins can do things like pay your gas fees or pre-fund your wallet. And so there's just major UX advantages to going the embedded wallet route.
I would echo everything David said and just say sometimes it's safer to not let the end user touch the private key to some extent, right? And I also think a big part of this is not so much always using self-custody, but simply that you can. By the simple fact that you can use it changes the dynamics of how this whole thing plays out. So I think that's a really good point to always go back to.
Well, I think that's a great point, Don. Would you mind like elaborating on what you mean by that? Because that is something I think about a lot as well, which is that having the option is really important.
Well, I'm put on the spot. So a bad analogy, because I live somewhere rural in Ireland, is all the farmers near me will always keep cash under their mattress, right? Because they remember the 2008 crisis. They remember all these things. So their level of sovereignty does matter, and they have some amounts, right, of assets put away for it. But I think it's just back to that control, right? If the merchant, if the provider, whoever is saying, look, if you really want control, you can have it, I think that's one of the strongest vote of confidence from a company you can get.
I think that's really well put. I also think the trend of embedded wallets is interesting because for a long time, crypto looked to onboard users through wallets by providing dApps. So it's, okay, I want to use this decentralized app, so I will fund a MetaMask wallet to access this dApp. And that was kind of the distribution channel of crypto. But I think a trend that we've been seeing, and it actually goes back to our last episode when we were talking about vaults, is that there is a subset of users that will do that and find that very valuable. There's also another subset of users that simply that user experience is just not acceptable. It's too technical. It's too painful or too many friction points. And so they need a different front end experience, which is kind of what we're seeing on the vaults front. I think also what we're seeing with the trend of embedded wallets. And I don't think that one is necessarily better than the other. It just seems to be that you're making trade-offs and what the use case and ultimate end user wants. And just providing that optionality, I think, is important.
Yeah. And so you're actually seeing that in networks as well. So if you look at like Tempo, the blockchain, right? It's being built from first principles on like payments use cases. And so they say, well, the, you know, Stripe or who was it? It was Stripe and Paradigm, I think, who are incubating Tempo, basically said, well, Ethereum's really built to run smart contracts and Bitcoin's built basically to be Bitcoin and Solana's built for trading, but none of these have really great UX for payments. And so let's build a chain from the ground up that is designed to make payments UX better. And so a big part of that is how there's not a separate native gas token, right? Like you can pay fees using a list of USD-based stablecoins. And they have designed their consensus around a set of rules that is specific to like high frequency payments. So you see that in a lot of places, whether it's changing how wallets work to appeal to a different audience or building networks from the ground up to appeal to certain use cases. You see this pattern all over the place.
I think what's interesting about Tempo is one, it's incubated by Stripe. And if you look at the people building it, it's effectively Ethereum's all-star crew, or at least some of the very, very heavyweights who were involved in Ethereum. And I think to Stripe's credit as well, right, they played around with the Lightning Network for Bitcoin. They played around with Solana with little success. So I don't think it's their first run or anything, but I think it's kind of interesting because we're getting this enterprise blockchain cycle kind of coming back. But this time I'm really confused as how genuine is it and how genuine is it not. But I think to your point, David, I think this time they really are genuinely trying to crack a lot of those payment problems from a very lived experience point of view.
Yeah, I think normally I would be more skeptical of like purpose-built L1s. But to me, payments is a big enough use case that it could justify a purpose-built network. So that's why I'm keeping a close eye on it. And I think one of the big questions around Tempo will be how decentralized their validator set ends up being. I think that's one of the biggest questions out there. And, you know, they say that they want to decentralize over time and be a true permissionless network. So we'll just have to see. I don't think there's a whole lot of activity on the network quite yet, but it will be interesting to see how it plays out.
Yeah, and I think adding to the other things they're working on, right, back to the Privy, back to the Bridge, they've also done a bunch of different other acquisitions, and they have products like, I think Link has 250 million users. So I think in some ways you can think of Tempo as kind of like not a proof of concept, but test. And if they start to see any sort of significant success in it, they can start to port over a lot of their volume and a lot of their clients slowly integrate it inside that system, which would be interesting to see. But yeah, I'm like you on the decentralized question, still waiting to find out.
I think that's a big question is, will they aggressively port business over and how fast? Because there are other big payment providers who have stable coins who have not been aggressive about porting over their existing business. So it'll be interesting to see how Stripe plays it.
Yeah. I mean, I'll give you an example. It's a bit of speculation, but if you're a merchant sitting inside the Stripe dashboard and all of a sudden you can get like better yield for some of the assets you have on platform and all this sort of stuff, I think it might make a meaningful change.
Definitely.
Yeah, I think certainly on the yield front, and then also on the settlement, the cost to settle front as well, right? The cost to settle a typical network fee on a credit card, I believe, is 2.5% to 3%. If you start to see single basis point cost of settlement, you know, I don't think the merchants are going to worry too much about level of centralization versus decentralization. At the end of the day, they care about their bottom line. But I think from a user's perspective, it will be interesting to watch how that decentralization trend plays out. If Stripe is able to kind of balance this building a decentralized blockchain with building something that is really cheap and easy to use from a merchant perspective, that's, I think, what I'm most interested in, because we've seen these waves of enterprise blockchains kind of bubble up and then die out over the years. So I'm curious to see how this one plays out. But with that, gentlemen, I think we're just about at time. Any final thoughts you'd like to leave our listeners with?
No, just at some point, we'll better do a follow-up on the agentic side of this. I think we can all be honest and say stablecoins are still primarily trading, soon to be payments, and then soon to be machine-to-machine. And it's a really interesting space to follow.
Yeah, certainly. I think that we will have to do a full 30 minutes on agentic payments again, because these 30-minute segments, they simply fly by and there's too much to cover, too many interesting things to discuss. But with that, thank you everyone for joining this edition of the FCAT Crypto Brief. David, Dom, thank you for joining. And Dom, welcome to the team. We're really excited to have you.
Thanks, everyone. Take care, guys.
Crypto as an asset class is highly volatile, can become illiquid at any time, and is for investors with a high risk tolerance. Crypto may also be more susceptible to market manipulation than securities. Crypto is not insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation or the Securities Investor Protection Corporation. Investors in crypto do not benefit from the same regulatory protections applicable to registered securities. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. This podcast was produced by the Fidelity Center for Applied Technology, also known as FCAT. FCAT does not offer digital assets, nor provide clearing or custody of such assets. It is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide tax, legal, insurance, or investment advice, and should not be construed as an offer to sell, a solicitation of an offer to buy, or a recommendation for any security or other asset by any Fidelity entity or third party. Views expressed are as of the date indicated, based on the information available at the time, and may change based on market or other conditions. Unless otherwise noted, the opinions provided are those of the authors and not necessarily those of Fidelity Investments or its affiliates. Fidelity does not assume any duty to update any of the information. Fidelity and any other third parties mentioned in the podcast are independent entities and are not affiliated. Mentioning them does not suggest a recommendation or endorsement by Fidelity. This information is not intended for distribution to or used by any person or entity in any jurisdiction or country where such distribution or use would be contrary to local law or regulation. Persons accessing this information are required to inform themselves about and observe such restrictions. Third-party trademarks appearing herein are the property of their respective owners. All others are the property of FMR LLC. Copyright 2026 FMR LLC. All rights reserved. 1040156.